Hi, welcome back, everyone. My name is Mike, and I am an alcoholic. There was something on the flyer that Jim put out that I wanted to read a little expanded version on from Language of the Heart. But before I get in, because that's really what we're going to key off of for the next 45 or 50 minutes or so. I don't think I can push it any past 50 minutes, but I have an alcoholic ego, so I may try. No, I'm just kidding. But there's something that I want to read to you that came to me just a couple months ago, and I put pen to paper because I got it in meditation. It was so profound to me, which means it's probably not worth 2 cents, but I'm going to read it to you anyway. It says, it sometimes seems that life has a tendency to come straight at us like a speeding bullet. The problem is that we think we're the target. We are not the target of life's happenings, but we think we are. The truth is that life just happens. The bullets are just random firings, but we think the problems in our lives are like a guided missile headed for a target on our forehead. But if the big book is correct when it says our troubles are of our own making, then we're the ones that paint the target, and sometimes we go out searching for the bullets. In other instances, we are sleeping when the bullets are fired and we're not alert enough to move out of the way. When we awaken spiritually, we realize that life is not out to get us. We are just another energy field that the bullets of life pass through. We are not the targets. On page 240 of Language of the Heart, and it was quoted on the flyer, but it was only halfway quoted as far as the full paragraph goes. And I want to read the full paragraph because I think it's really powerful. It says, the chances are better than even that we shall locate our trouble in our misunderstanding and neglect of AA's step 11, prayer, meditation, and the guidance of God. The other steps can keep most of us sober and somehow functioning. But step 11 can keep us growing if we try hard and work at it continually. If we expend even 5% of the time on step 11 that we habitually and rightly lavish on step 12, the results can be wonderfully far-reaching. That is an almost uniform experience of those who constantly practice step 11. I found it real interesting that it says if we spend just 5% of the time on our conscious contact with God and maintaining our conscious contact with God via the vehicles of prayer and meditation, we're going to be so much for the better. If we spend just 5% of the time that we do with helping other alcoholics, we're just going to skyrocket as far as our spirituality is concerned. I believe Dr. Bob once quoted that if we spend, I'm not sure what the actual figure is, but I'll make it up, like I do with page numbers in the big book sometimes. I think he says if we expend half the amount of energy after going after the 12 steps and trying to find a relationship with our Heavenly Father or God as we understand Him, if we expend half of the amount of energy that we did when it comes to spirituality, as we did with our drinking, we're not going to fail. We can't fail. Thanks for sharing.
My name is Bill. I'm an alcoholic American.
Thanks for sharing.
I talked about those two voices within us. For me, that's the essence of a conscious contact. Which voice is leading me in each moment? And when I realize that the wrong voice is leading me, getting off that train and getting back on the beam. I've actually heard it put two ways. These are two little parables. It says, a battle of fearless forces rages within me. One side is an eagle, which carries me soaring above the valleys of my soul in search for truth on wisdom's peaks. The other side is a raging wolf. It tears apart my broken wings and drags me to the depths of self-defeat. Which one succeeds? The one I feed. And then this is an old Cherokee teaching. An old Cherokee is teaching his grandson about life. A fight is going on inside of us, he said to the boy. It is a terrible fight, and it is between two wolves. One is evil, he is anger, envy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, superiority, and ego. The other one is good. He is joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith. This same fight is going on inside of you and inside every person, too. The grandson thought about it for a minute and then asked his grandfather, which wolf wins? The old Cherokee simply replied, the one you feed. What's interesting, I used to always refer to that as the two dogs. That I have a good dog and a bad dog. And what's interesting is that when I was out there, I could do things that were ruthless and not very nice. And I very often didn't feel bad about it. I felt you deserved it. I mean, if it's all about me, you know, I got to do ruthless things. And in coming into AA and in trying to practice, you know, I think it's interesting that in the first paragraph of how it works, it mentions honest or honesty three times. And even says that this is a way of living which demands rigorous honesty. First of all, I need to ask myself, do I feel that's important? Secondly, I have to ask myself, am I living that type of life? Now in trying to practice, you know, an honest life or a spiritual life or whatever you want to call it, a godly or loving life, whatever, today sometimes I can do some small thing that I know is wrong and it just rips me apart. My conscience just comes against me in no uncertain terms over some little thing. Now, I'm feeding that dog a whole lot more. I'm feeding the good dog a whole lot more. And now my conscience comes against me before it gets to be, you know, way out of hand. You know what I mean? I can still make mistakes, but well before it's out of hand, I know and knew even probably before that what I was about to do was wrong. I am so grateful for that. But the thing is that now I'm feeding that dog. Before I was feeding the bad dog. And it's interesting because neither dog or neither voice ever dies. You know what I mean? Both of them are always there. But just one very often is stronger because that's the one that I'm feeding more. So our question to you is, you know, in each moment, which dog am I feeding? Inevitably, for me, that's the sort of the spiritual path or sort of the essence of being in the moment and the essence of which voice am I following right now, right here, right now? Which voice is the one that's leading me? The Oxford group, which is where AA got all the steps from and most of the spiritual principles, used to have something that was called the Four Absolutes. It was love, purity, unselfishness, and honesty. For me, that is a big part of my spiritual walk and my path. What's interesting is that in the resentment inventory in the fourth step, it talks about where was I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or frightened. That's the opposite of the Four Absolutes. Frightened is the opposite of love. Dishonest is the opposite of honesty. Selfish is the opposite of unselfishness, and self-seeking is the opposite of purity, because not only is purity sort of a sexual thing with our acts and our thoughts, but it's also, are our motives pure? You know, am I helping somebody because I just want to help them, or am I helping them because I want something out of it? You know, I mean, that's also an aspect of purity. And also in the 10th step, it talks about continue to watch for selfishness, which is the opposite of unselfishness, dishonesty, which is the opposite of honesty, resentment, which is the opposite of purity, and fear, which is the opposite of love. And then the 11th step, he mentions it again. It talks about when we constructively review our day at the end of the day. It says, was I resentful? Was I selfish? Was I dishonest? Was I afraid? Again, the opposite of the Four Absolutes. Although he doesn't mention the Four Absolutes in our literature, he mentions the opposite of it, because the opposite of it is the ways that we're falling short. So for me, if these are the ways that we're falling short, then I need to also look at the other standard. Am I growing today? Am I more loving today than I was a year ago? That means I'm growing spiritually. Am I more honest today than I was a year ago? That means I'm growing spiritually. That means I'm on the beam more. Am I growing in unselfishness? Am I growing in empathetic listening to other people? When people are talking to me, am I really there just listening to them, or am I waiting for them to stop so I can respond? Because I've experienced, you know, I can relate to that at times. You know, am I more reasonable in traffic today? That means that I'm growing spiritually. You know, if growing spiritually is a priority, or if it's a part of this, how can I tell? How can I regulate it? How can I see, am I growing? You know what I mean? It's real easy to say, oh, yeah, you know, I pray more. Oh, yeah, I'm closer to God now than I was a year ago. But what does that mean? What if I'm talking to somebody who doesn't even know when you use the word God what that means, and in some cases sort of has a negative definition? Because I've talked with people that God was this negative, to be feared kind of a thing. You know, something that for me is really important, not only with the four absolutes, but, you know, there's ways that I can regulate, or there's ways that even sometimes just in the moment I can see, you know, am I growing spiritually? Am I able to handle situations today that used to baffle me? Am I handling situations today that used to cause me to go off? You know, Mike, we had touched upon it before. There's usually four areas that I can, besides sort of the four absolutes, I'm just kind of seeing if I'm growing in certain areas spiritually. There's four areas that, for me, is the ultimate test to how am I doing spiritually. One is spend a week with your parents. How well do you handle that? There's a sign of how you're doing spiritually. When you're in traffic and you're running late, there's a sign of how I'm doing spiritually. You know, the other one was, Mike mentioned it, I whispered it in his ear, so I'll take credit for it. You know, how am I doing at my home group's business meeting? You know what I mean? Because there's those people that like push our buttons. And the cool thing is that the issue isn't that they're pushing our buttons. The issue is that we have buttons to push. If we can get rid of those buttons, they don't have buttons to push anymore. And that's a key thing for me in sort of a technique of passing along about the holidays, is that these people in our family, they're not pushing our buttons. They're letting us know. They're on some level, I view that as they're in my life to let me know there's something more that I need to work on. And I am grateful for them pushing my buttons, because I see that there's something more within me that I need to work on. It talks about in the 12 of 12 that it's a spiritual axiom that anytime somebody else disturbs us, there's something wrong with us. It's not an easy thing. It's not, again, I don't like that news. But in trying to work toward getting more freedom, those are things that I found is my truth. And then the fourth spot, which I don't know if we're going to do it, but we were thinking about it. The fourth one, the test on how am I doing spiritually, is how do I do in those moments when I'm just with myself, within myself, not watching TV, not watching the radio, just alone inside myself for perhaps a five-minute period of time. What's my inner state during those moments? Is my mind and my emotions beating me up? Am I comfortable just being alone? Am I comfortable just being in silence, just all right, just here and now? Or is there this immense turmoil, this immense uncomfortability? I don't want to, you know, I have to have the radio on. I have to have the TV on. I have to have the radio on when I'm driving my car. I just can't be alone with myself. That's another sign for me on how we're doing spiritually.
There's a fifth one that Bill usually doesn't talk about, but we talk about it between us. Any dog owners in the house tonight? Anyone own a dog? All right, so the dog owns you, all right? No. If when you come home from work and you come through the door, does your dog growl at you? You know, that's a pretty good indication of where my spirituality is.
Kids ran away.
Well, we have a program of recovery that will work for you, too.
He must not have been going to our dog. That was stolen from Cersei. Now the 10-second exercise that distinguishes between those two voices within us. For me, I've heard people do it, and I remember the first time that we did it to a group of people, there was like 100 and something people there, and it was just amazing. You could feel a shift in the room that everybody just kind of got it, and I hope that happens again. Okay, now this is real simple, just a 10-second exercise. Just for now, just kind of get comfortable. Just get comfortable, and for the next 10 seconds, I'd like you to do one thing and one thing only. For the next 10 seconds, just close your eyes and observe your thoughts. Thank you. Now, what's interesting about that exercise is that usually, for those 10 seconds, no thoughts come across our mind. Now, our ego doesn't want to draw attention to itself. What our ego wants is to run the show without us realizing that it's running the show. Like I said before, we have a grand central station mind. All these things come flying through. For some people in meditation, when thoughts come by, they're told to just observe their thoughts like a cloud passing by, and then the thought goes by and it's gone. It doesn't control us. We don't have to buy into it. We don't have to agree with it. We don't have to attach to it and say, yeah, that's a thought that I want to have as a driving thought. So it's interesting in that, you know, our ego, or that part that kind of just talks to us constant, that constant chatter within us, that it doesn't want to draw attention to itself. It wants to act as if it's, you don't notice, you know, don't notice me, I'm running the show, but don't notice. But there's another aspect of that exercise that for me is really mind-blowing. What was observing your thoughts? Something outside of your thoughts was looking at your thoughts. That for me is those two parts within us. There's this constant chatter and there's this ego aspect that's just this constant judge, this constant director, this constant, what I would like to call the ego. But there's this other, all-knowing, all-comfortable, all-loving, all-reassuring part of us that's there, that's kind of observing, wanting us to turn to it, but that we don't that often turn to it. And that's for me what the goal of meditation is to separate ourselves from our thoughts and to tap into that aspect within us that I think is that spark within us, our spiritual essence, that part within us that is of God. There are two consciences going on there, but we don't notice it most of the time because the ego is the louder first one to speak most often. But then when it talks about that inspiration, when it talks about an intuitive thought, when it talks about that we're on a much higher plane when our motives are cleared of wrong thinking, that's separating from the ego, and that's trying to tap into that wisdom, that incredible knowing, that incredible reassurant part of us within us that is always there, but that most often we really don't notice it. We just hear that one because that's the one that's loudest. But there is this other part of us, and that for me is the goal of the steps, is to get you to have conscious contact with that part within you, because for me, I don't see God as out there, over there, up there. I see God as within me. My solution is within me, just like my problem is within me. I call the problem the ego, and I call the solution God, or higher power, or whatever you want to call it. But it's always right here. It's always right now. It always wants us to turn to it. It's always there. But for some reason, we just don't notice it all the time. We always, you know, some people call it your conscience, because, you know, there is that part within us that every once in a while says, Bill, I don't think this is a good idea, but, you know, very often we'll just do it anyway, you know what I mean? You can call it whatever you want, but we all have it. We've all experienced it. We all know exactly what I'm talking about when I describe this stuff, about the two parts within us, the two dogs, the ego and the part which I believe is of God. So that's another thing that I wanted to throw out, because especially with the holidays and especially with family and old issues and all of that, what seems really obvious is to do the work of the steps on these people, which inevitably reaches us to a point where we're free from most of it, if not all of it. But then when it comes up in the moment, if we can just be loving and honest and a little bit more pure with our motives and unselfish, all of a sudden it just changes the relationship and they don't have to do anything. All of a sudden, the whole relationship changed and they haven't done a thing. Just our perspective toward the relationship has changed. And our way of treating these people and our way of looking at these people just all of a sudden changes, and all of a sudden everything changes and they haven't done a thing. Anthony DeMello says that, you know, it's a whole lot easier to put on slippers than to carpet the whole world.
But how do we get to that place? How do we get to that place when we have conscious contact, where we're just able to tap in, so to speak? There's a lot of work that has to be done. For me, the first step that I can say that I really consciously touched that truth that's deep down within us, and I'll talk a little bit more about that before we close. See, I think truth, the great reality, my true inner nature, God, I think all these terms just mean the same thing. I think these terms or words, you know, somebody said it once, when it comes to trying to describe God or spirituality, silence just makes so much more sense. And I believe that to be true today, because sometimes I can get trapped in the dogma of what God means. You know, you may call God Jesus. You may call God Buddha. You may call God higher power. And if I get trapped into the word, if I get trapped in the pointer, that which directs me to the power, if I get trapped in that, I'm going to be trapped. I really have a way with words sometimes, as you guys can tell. So I try to see what the word is pointing to today. So if you hear me say God, higher power, consciousness, intuition, great reality, my true inner nature, that which what I was before I was even here, any crazy kooky stuff like that, to me it just all means truth. It's all pointing to truth. I was writing an inventory about, I guess it was about a year ago, and that's when I discovered the place in the steps that I really hit truth for the first time. For you, it may have been your first step. You may have had such a deep and profound surrender experience in your first step that you just knew truth then. I mean, a lot of people have their spiritual experience, so to speak, right in their first step. Truth began to speak to me, or rather, I began to hear truth. I began to hear that still, small, quiet voice of God within. In my first inventory, though I didn't know it. And upon subsequent inventories, I finally began to realize what was going on. And it struck me about a year ago that in the big book, Bill makes this statement about being catapulted and rocketed into this fourth dimension of existence. He talks about it on page 8, and he talks about it again on page 25, about this fourth dimension of existence. And I didn't know what that was. You know, I just thought Bill was, oh, here he goes, being creative and lofty again, you know, fourth dimension of existence. Woo, spooky. You know. And it struck me when I was writing inventory one day. Anybody in this room, well, I hate to embarrass anyone, but I will. How many people in the room have written four-column inventory as described in the big book? You know, the four columns I'm resentful at, what they did to me, makes me feel like this, and where am I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened in the fourth column. That's what I mean by four-column inventory. So I was doing that one day, and I realized that directly reflects the four dimensions, at least to me, that Bill Wilson was talking about when he talked about being rocketed into and catapulted into the fourth dimension of existence. And I began to ponder in meditation, what are these four dimensions that he's talking about? And I don't know if this is true or not. I'm not going to be as bold to say that I could speak for Bill Wilson. Maybe 2 years ago I would have, but, you know, I don't know if this is true or not, but it helps me. And I really, because our big book is just shot through with it. I really believe that the four dimensions of life are physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. Again, here they go again with, once the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. If you look at the first column of inventory, I'm resentful at the person, institution, or principle. Usually that resentment I have is towards some physical being. So that's body. That's the physical dimension. The resentment that I perpetuate is towards what I thought that person did to me. What I thought, I heard the, see, we're striking truth already. I hit it a couple months ago, maybe I'll tell you about that. what I think the other person did to me, that's my second column. On page 65, they call it the cause of my resentment. I'm resentful at Bill because he spoke for 12 minutes instead of 10. You know, something real petty like that.
Again?
Again. I should be used to it by now. What I think he did to me, second column, the dimension, the mental dimension, the second dimension. So we have physical and then mental. The third column is, how does that resentment, when Bill did that to me, how does that affect me? Does it affect my self-esteem, my pocketbook, my ambitions, my pride, on and on and on. I love to call the third column of resentment inventory the victim column. You know, sometimes I love to walk around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous with a big V on my forehead. And fortunate enough for me, I have people in my life that'll point out that I have that V on my forehead, and they won't let me continue to be one of the still sick and suffering. Because when I'm sick and suffering, usually means that I'm still. And I don't want to be a still sick and suffering. But I call that third column my victim column, but what it really is my emotions. It's my emotional state. When I think so-and-so did such-and-such to me, it caused, or I think it caused, certain feelings and emotions to arise from within me. I find that out later that that's a lie because of the spiritual axiom in the 10th step that Bill talked about before, but they give us a little time to catch up. Big Book's very generous with that. So to kind of end this long explanation, the fourth column, I finally get to see my part. I finally get to see the truth. I finally get to see where I start the ball rolling in each and every resentment, fear, misconduct, harm that I've ever had in my life and will continue to have. And I really believe that the fourth column is about truth. And I really believe that for the first time in my life, I get to enter the spiritual dimension of existence. That fourth column is all about God, folks. It's where I find... I mean, anyone in this room start writing inventory and you get to that fourth column and it just comes from left field and boom, it's on the paper and you didn't even have to think about it. It's just there and you know that's the truth and you don't even want to look at it and you know it's true. I don't want to know that I screwed this person over. I don't want to know that I'm selfish to this person. I don't want to know that I lied to this person, but yet there it is right on that paper and I can't dispute it. That's truth. Truth comes from within me. And the Big Book says that that's the only place that God can be found. Talks about in the second step that we have to find a power greater than ourselves that'll solve our problem. Where and how are we to find this problem? And 10 pages later, they tell us exactly where this power is located. For deep down within every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. I don't have to go out here looking for it. I don't have to go to this church, this monastery, this spiritual guru in India. I don't have to go to the Himalayas. It's right here, now. Funny how we're back to that word again, huh? Deep down within every man, woman, and child in this room right now, this very moment, is the fundamental idea of God. God is deep down within us. That is the truth. That is the small, still, quiet voice. That is the good dog. That's our conscience. That's our intuition. That's that part of us that wants to be sober, happy, joyous, free, loving, kind, tolerant, patient. Yeah, even to the mother-in-law. That's that part of us that was always there, even when we were drinking and drugging like mad dogs. That's that part of us that will always continue to be there for the rest of our lives.
So my concept of a higher power was not one that I would want to turn to help, to be honest with you. And then I was given an immense amount of respect when I came to AA, and they told me, Bill, you can believe whatever you want. But I think there's a little bit of an asterisk next to step two. And what step two says is that you can believe whatever you want as long as it's not you. And for me, that was really important because I was the ruler and controller of my life. And for me, you know, Mike said about the surrenders, you know, in the first step, I needed to surrender to alcohol. But in the third step, and I think again in the seventh step, I need to surrender my will to a higher power. Because my life run on my will was a nightmare, even during the 3.5 years period of time that I wasn't drinking. So for me, the 12 steps are really one step with 12 parts, and that's from living that goes out of here to living that goes out of our heart, which is where I believe my higher power resides. And in experiencing that transition and in experiencing the beauty and freedom of if she stays, I can be comfortable, and if she goes, I can be comfortable. And if I have the job, I can be comfortable. If I don't have the job, I can be comfortable. And if I have the car, I can be comfortable. If I don't have the car, I can be comfortable. That life has just completely changed without anything happening out there. It's captured so beautifully in our expression that it's an inner job. You know what I mean? Chuck Chamberlain used to talk about, you know, putting on, just cleaning our glasses, that we need to put on a spiritual set of glasses now. That I always looked at life from me being the center of the universe, and now I need to believe that love or God or others' centeredness, that needs to be the center of my universe. And in changing from the compass of it's all about me to the compass of I want to do what God wants me to do, and I want to be loving, and I want to be honest, and all of that, that all of a sudden that compass worked. And I wasn't crashing into people all the time, and I wasn't stepping on everybody's toes, and I was very comfortable within myself, and I was right with almost everybody around me. And I just came here to not drink. There was a guru that lived on a hill. This is a story. There was a guru that lived on a hill, and below him there was a farmer. Now, this farmer never liked the guru because he kind of felt that the guru didn't work and that he was a slacker. And he was a farmer, and he was the real deal because he worked hard, and he was a man, man's man. And one day he had a lot of cattle. He had a lot of cows. And one day, one of the cows broke through the fence, and the whole entire herd of cows left. And this farmer was devastated because his cattle was the biggest part of his crop or the biggest part of his income, and now that was just all gone. So he went up to see the guru guy, and he said, something terrible has happened. All my cows have left. This is devastating. The cows were the biggest part of my income, and now they're all gone. Isn't this a terrible thing? And the guru looked at him and said, good or bad, I really don't know. And the farmer went back down to his farm, cursing under his breath, because he never liked the guru anyway. He didn't know why he went there. And a couple days later, because there was a hole in the fence, this big, huge herd of wild horses came onto his land. And he real quickly closed up the fence, and now he had these horses, and horses are so much better than cows. And he was totally psyched, and he was totally happy. And he went up to see the guru guy, and he said, something wonderful has happened. Wild horses have ran onto my property. Horses are so much better than cows. This is a really wonderful thing. Isn't this wonderful? And the guru guy looked at him and said, you know, good or bad, I really don't know. And again, he shook his head and he went back down to his farm. And a couple days later, his son was trying to break one of the horses, and the horse threw him off his back, and he landed on his leg wrong, and he broke his leg. And the father was devastated because his son was in a lot of pain with a broken leg. And he went back up to see the guru guy, and he said, something terrible has happened. My son has been thrown from one of the wild horses, and he's broken his leg. This is terrible. Isn't this a terrible thing? And the guru guy looked at him and said, good or bad, I really don't know. And then a couple weeks later, war broke out in the country. And soldiers came around recruiting soldiers to young people to join the soldier ranks. And because his son had a broken leg, the soldiers didn't take him. So now the farmer was totally excited and totally happy. His son didn't get taken to war. And he goes back up to see the guru guy, and he says to him, something wonderful has happened. The soldiers didn't take my son. Isn't this wonderful? And the guru guy looked at him and said, good or bad, I really don't know. That describes my life. There have been things in my life that were incredibly wonderful that almost killed me. That I would view, and that anybody here, if I was to tell you, would say, this was a good thing. And they almost took me out. And there were things in my life that were incredibly hideous, and they were incredibly terrible. And if you were to view them, and if you were to judge them, and if I was to tell you what happened, you would say, wow, that was really bad. And you know what? Most of the time, if not all the time, those things was where I transformed myself with a higher power and with these steps and with this program to become the person that I'm trying to become that I think was exactly what God wanted me to be in the first place. I have tried to move away, and I'd like to pass along, trying to move away from good or bad because I do not have the perspective to be able to judge that. My addiction and my alcoholism was a ruthless thing. I did things to people that I wish I wouldn't have happened. But if those things wouldn't have happened, it wouldn't have gotten to the point where I would have come into AA, and it wouldn't have gotten to the point where I would have considered a spiritual way out. So I am incredibly grateful for those things in my life today. Marriages have ended. I went through an incredible amount of pain. It brought me closer to myself and things that I didn't like about myself. It brought me closer to my higher power. I am truly grateful for those bad moments in my life today. I do not view them as bad things in my life anymore. For me, this is the concept of God. For me, this is the concept of my spirituality. You know, I've talked with people that, married couples, that were having two different experiences in their relationship. One of the couple was viewing their relationship as, these are opportunities for growth. The differences that we have and the problems that we're having are opportunities for growth. And the other person in the marriage was saying, no, this is incompatibility, I want out. That was as the result of where each one of them were coming from spiritually. Exact situation, two extreme points of view as the result of where the person was coming from spiritually. Incredibly powerful examples and incredibly powerful story with the guru and the farmer, because I believe that God oversees everything and that he always has my best interests in mind, even when I don't think at any one moment. I wish marriages hadn't ended. I wish I hadn't gone through the pain. I love these women, and I wouldn't have wanted it to end. But I have become a better person for going through what I went through. Didn't do anything that I regretted after the marriage broke up and had to make amends for that I would have never had the opportunity to go through and grown from if that didn't happen to me. I'm going to close my aspect of this with a quote which for me describes my concept of God. This is from A Course in Miracles. It says the following. What could you not accept if you but knew that everything that happens, all events, past, present, and to come, are gently planned by one whose only purpose is your good, or perhaps spiritual growth? What could you not accept if you but knew that everything that happens, all events, past, present, and to come, are gently planned by one whose only purpose is your good?
Bill had mentioned a pretty popular AA speaker in early AA, and I guess he passed away somewhere in the 80s by the name of Chuck Chamberlain. And one of the things that Chuck always said was, what you are looking for, you are looking with. What we are looking for, we are looking with. I'll talk more about that in a minute, and I actually have an exercise that I want to close with, but first I want to read this quote about meditation. It's from a book called Meditation in Ecstasy. And by the way, I'm getting closer and closer to the point where prayer meditation is no longer a practice for me, but yet rather it's becoming a way of life. Prayer meditation, spirituality, our 10th and the 11th step, has become a way of life for me today. They're not just spiritual exercises. They're not just principles that I can practice some of the time. The quote is, meditation simply means becoming empty of all the contents of the mind, memory, imagination, thoughts, desires, expectations, projections, moods. One has to go on emptying oneself of all the content. The greatest day in life is when you cannot find anything to throw out, when there is only pure emptiness. In that emptiness, you find your pure consciousness. Remember, I said a lot of these words to me mean the same thing. Pure consciousness, truth, God, higher power, however you want to look at it. I have an exercise that I want to close with. About 2 years ago, my spiritual advisor at the time brought me through it, and it totally revolutionized my life and the way I look and feel and think about things. And it may seem a little weird in the beginning, and if it doesn't feel comfortable to you, then just don't do it. You can just disregard it. What this man asked me to do was find out what I really am. When Bill said, when we're trying to play God, I believe that's my ego. You know, when I want that concept of a higher power to be me, you know, the old timers told us, you can choose anything you want for God, just make sure it's not yourself. Well, that part of me that wants to be God, that's my ego. What I'm going to talk about is the opposite, is something different. The exercise is, if we chop off your arms, are you still you? If you lose your legs, are you still you? If we take out all your organs inside your body and transplant them with new ones, are you still you? If, God forbid, you go into a coma tonight and you don't have any rationalization of your mental faculties, are you still you? If we strip away any emotions, feelings from the years past and the years to come, are you still you? Have you ever had the experience where you're in deep inner turmoil? You're crushed. You're so sad. You're mourning, whether it be the death of someone or the death of a relationship, like Bill talked about. And you're experiencing so much pain in your life. But yet, there's this place deep down within, and you know you're going to be okay. Nod your head if you identify, if you ever had that experience. So if you have this deep sadness and pain and struggle and strife, and we remove all that, are you still you? What's left? The emptiness that quote talked about. But somehow within that emptiness, we become more full and our lives become fuller and our spirits become fuller than ever before. You see, the process of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is a process of subtraction, not addition. My whole life I thought more was better. And now I'm comfortable with less is where it's at. Face and be rid of these obstacles in our path that blocked us off from that one who has all power. So maybe in your meditation, maybe tomorrow morning if you choose to do so, and again, you can just disregard this, but sit down and find that quiet place that we all have within us, deep down within. And ask yourself, what was I before today? What was I before last year? What was I 20 years ago? I'm not talking about the mask that our egos like to put on. I'm not talking about I'm a husband, I'm a computer system administrator. I'm not even talking about I'm an AA member. What were you when you were a child? What were you when you were in the womb? And take it back as far back as your spirit allows you to, What were you before that? What were you before that? What were you before that? See, I believe that I am not the who that my ego likes to tell me I am, but I am the what that I had been searching for my whole life. I am not God, but I know today that I am everything that is of God. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Am I willing? God bless you and happy holidays.
Cosmic man.